You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome back, cowboys and cowgirls, to another Ingles and Ian, a Cowboys Ride for Free podcast. And as always, you're a good friend of mine, Mr. Ian, but not as all the Admiral of the Abacus, the Vizier of Visualization, the Saze of Stats, Mr. Parker at Stats of War. How are you doing today? How's everyone doing today? We're here to talk about Big 12. How's everyone?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, guys. Football's coming a little quicker every day. It feels like the season's getting here. So I'm excited to dive in and talk about some stuff.
Week zero is like, what, 3.5 weeks away? Like, the first full week of college football is a month today. So yeah, we're right there.
We're 24 days away, I believe.
Dang.
From week zero. So that gets me fired up.
And everyone's looking forward to that Vanderbilt Hawaii game on week zero.
Oh, the 9:30 kickoff. Oh yeah. I'll be watching.
I don't know how many of our friends remember. Parker is at Stats of War. Great Twitter follow. Parker, remind everyone who listens to us what you do, you know, all of the good stuff you do on the internet. And with that, he's frozen up.
Man. That's a bummer.
It is a bummer.
He's got to come back at some point.
So, Ian, we're a month away from college football. Mm-hmm. OSU camp opened up today.
Mm-hmm.
Thoughts, feelings, concerns, what do you got coming on?
Well, it's camp. I mean, it's one of those things where I don't pay too much stock into it, just because unless there's a significant injury or there is some significant news concerning the roster. Oh, he's back. Parker's back.
Just completely went out.
Man, I had the best intro for you ever. And you're gone. So I was saying to our audience, I don't know if they remember when you came on last year. Parker does a lot of great stuff for a lot of great places on the internet. So remind us what you do, all of that good stuff, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I think that I'm kind of all over the place. My unofficial title can be online sports guy. But yeah, I do the BetUS College Football Show. We do some picks and predictions twice a week on YouTube at noon central on Tuesdays and Wednesdays during the season. And I have, you know, some other things here and there. I host the Purple Theory podcast, which is a little bit of a passion project. My friend and co-host Grant McGalliard and I break down TCU from a numbers perspective, although we try to live in that gray area of looking at the numbers, but also having a beer and talking football.
Nice. All right. So tonight's sort of idea is we're going to talk about the Big 12. We're about a month out. Obviously this is Oklahoma State podcast. So kind of, how do you see the Big 12 falling out, Parker?
Yeah, I think that this is as wide open as the Big 12 has been in quite some time, specifically because the last couple of years, it's been the perception, especially in preseason, has been Oklahoma and then whoever can get that second spot. And with Oklahoma's coaching change, with the turnover they have at the quarterback position and the defensive performance they had last season, I mean, they're absolutely going to be scrapping to get one of those two spots as well. So for the first time in a long time, I do really feel like we have a truly open Big 12. I think as I'm doing my season previews and Grant and I are talking on the Purple Theory podcast about teams in depth, I could talk myself into like 7 of these teams being in Arlington. I don't know that I love picking some of those teams, but if everything goes right for a certain team, I mean, I think you could see any one of these kind of seven, eight teams get to Arlington, get to the Big 12 championship. You've got a couple teams with north of 80% returning production. You've got some new transfer quarterbacks, and despite some turnover with, you know, TCU, Texas Tech, Oklahoma, you do have a lot of continuity with coaching staff at Baylor, Iowa State, at Kansas, and at Texas. So a lot of interesting storylines and maybe as open a Big 12 as we've seen in recent memory.
So my thought is that, you know, especially with OU, they lost pretty much their entire offensive coaching staff, right? And everyone's always been, hey, you know, it's OU, they're going to do what they're going to do. But this is like the first time in a long time where especially the offensive side of the ball is completely done. So what do you think about that in their new coaching staff? And they lost their top two quarterbacks. They've lost a wide receiver. They've lost a lot of five-star guys who are supposed to come in this year. What do you think about that? And he's gone again.
Dadgummit.
Ian, what do you think about that?
Just the way OU recruits on a national brand, they're usually, you know, top 10, top 15 recruiting wise, that I don't think it hurts them as bad as we're thinking it does.
Well, what about
it might hurt them this year, but next year I think they'll be just fine.
But we're not talking about next year. We're talking about this year. But I'm more thinking about the coaching staff. There's so much change on the offensive side of the ball. I don't know how well. I think a lot of us saw that Athletic post about like all the changes that happened because the USC coach left, and then like pretty much the entire offensive side of the ball from like linebackers coach up left OU. And that is pretty crazy. And so I don't know. I don't trust it. You cannot go that well so long. Right.
To counter argument you, Jeff Lebby is a guy who at Ole Miss, they run the air raid. OU's been running the air raid. That offense playbook is going to pretty much stay the same, I would imagine. And I would assume with Venables, they'd run a 4-3 instead of, I think, if they've been running a 5-2-4. That might be a little bit of an adjustment period, but OU's defense has not been the best the past few years. So,
You can't lose that many guys on the offensive side of the ball and not have a
Alabama.
Especially when you lose the top two quarterbacks.
Alabama did it a few years ago.
Yeah, that's Bama.
With Tua and Jalen,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
and
that's bleeping Bama. Bama is, there's Bama and there's the rest of college sports. I mean, that is just how it is.
I mean, OU's not that far off. Compared to they're not that far off.
All right, I'm about to start cursing, so Parker, you gotta jump in here.
I think that, you know, Oklahoma's offensive turnover is actually something I'm not super worried about. They kept Bill Biedenbaugh at offensive line, and I think that he is a really, really good offensive line coach and recruiter and development of talent, and kind of keeping him there gives them a lot of continuity. That, you know, you start to look at the key elements and the path for offensive success for Oklahoma is right there, right? They've got perhaps the two best tackles in Anton Harrison and Wanya Morris in the conference, or at least very much in the conversation for best tackle duo in the conference. And if you look at their wide receiver core, I mean, with Marvin Mims, and I mean, they're going to be fine at wide receiver and have plenty of options there. And running back Eric Gray, super experienced. So the big question on offense, just what can Dylan Gabriel do? Well, Jeff Lebby has built an offense around Dylan Gabriel before. And granted, he'll be challenged in a way that he hasn't necessarily been challenged, that him being Gabriel there, and potentially has some issues with not getting the ball downfield, but surviving in the pocket and making throws into tight windows, which Oklahoma struggled with last year. If you watch a lot of Oklahoma's film, they really struggled to kind of make their progressions, make their second and third reads when the first read wasn't there. A lot of times Spencer Rattler would just avoid checkdowns. Like, he could have just had 5 free yards and was struggling to do that. As for the defense, I mean, they were really, really bad last season. 123rd in EPA, expected points added per pass, which was, allowing almost a quarter of a point in expectation when an opponent passed against them. But they were 18th in the rush. And if you look at how teams approach them, teams really, really just rushed against Oklahoma. And passed against Oklahoma, which meant they were only rushing in kind of these positive situations. So we'll see kind of this weird paradox this season where the overall quality of the defense might not change very much, but the passing defense should be much better as the rushing defense is not as good. They had what, six guys drafted. And so for Oklahoma, I think I'm a little bit more concerned about how quickly Brent Venables can turn this defense into a functioning whole unit, not two separate units that have an obvious imbalance. So that's what I'm looking at with Oklahoma, is really the question of Gabriel and the question of how the defense can kind of normalize and not be so asymmetric next season, this season.
It's good stuff right there, man. That's good stuff. I mean, I agree with exactly what you're saying. Now, I want to talk about real quick, because I don't understand this. Like, what's the deal with the Texas Tech TCU rivalry that I just saw on Twitter? There was just some beefing or whatever, and now Texas Tech's just flying cactus emojis. I don't even – what's going on with that?
Texas Tech has been in the proverbial desert for a while. They have been bad and been unhappy, and they tried to fire their coach 2 years ago and couldn't do it and just didn't really even want to hire Matt Wells. A lot of the boosters did, and they haven't been good on the football field in a long time. And so they're taking their social media kind of excitement about the new program. They're taking the wins when they can get them. TCU's program didn't help with that. So one, TCU is restricting single game tickets for Texas Tech, which they've done in the past because most of Texas Tech people don't like Lubbock at all. And so they all live in DFW. And I understand, certainly can empathize with the program saying, hey, we're not going to give you first dibs on single game tickets to come flood our stadium, as Texas Tech, who has a huge living alumni base compared to TCU's very small enrollment and very small alumni base. TCU's athletic director responded to like a rando 200 follower, you know, Texas Tech anon account. And so Texas Tech jumped on that. And then TCU's director of recruiting went on a rant I probably wouldn't have posted had I been him, about how, you know, the opportunity for exposure is better, and don't take $25,000 just to go to the desert. And Texas Tech is just, you know, they're doing a good job with the branding and steering into excitement about the new coach and the new season, and doing everything they can to avoid talking about their results on the field in the past, and framing it really well. So, you know, people argue on Twitter. We need real football games to happen sooner rather than later.
Yeah. For one of the interesting things I've been seeing online is I've seen anywhere between Baylor being 8-4 and winning the Big 12 again. You have any thoughts on that?
I like Baylor. We're actually going to, Grant and I are going to do our Baylor preview tonight. So I've got a lot of stuff that I've kind of been diving in there. I think they're really interesting last year because they did a good job of kind of controlling what they could control and let other people make mistakes. I think being Oklahoma State guys, you guys are probably somewhat familiar with wrestling, but it's kind of this always infuriating guy to wrestle against who would never shoot first, who would never go for a takedown, but would just wait for you to do something and then try and capitalize on the slightest of mistakes. Baylor kind of plays football like that. Their special teams, you know, they have the longest net kickoff yardage. They have the lowest variance on their kickoff yardage. They have the most touchbacks of anyone. And they had a lot of the fewest offensive line penalties. I mean, just a lot of they controlled what they can control. They coupled that with having some absolute stars on defense: Jalen Petrie, Terrell Bernard. On offense, Abraham Smith, really stout running back. Tristan Ebner, when he was healthy, is a really solid running back, should contribute to an NFL roster. And Tyquan Thornton, who ran a 4.28 at the NFL Combine, just an absolute freak. This year, they're going to be able to do that kind of control we can control. They're going to have to replace a lot. They have to replace over 75% of all of their receiving targets and over 75% of all of their rushing attempts. That is a lot of turnover. That doesn't even speak to the fact that they're losing more than 50% of their defensive production as well. So there's a lot of variance, a lot of unknowns with Baylor. Really works in their favor that the conference is pretty open, because again, they do play system football well, and they have one of the better offensive lines. People will tell you they have one of the best defensive lines. I think they have one of the best interior defensive lines, and have some absolute, you know, really, really troublesome guys there. But because their cornerbacks and safeties and linebackers are going to be so new and kind of exposed, I think there's some opportunities for that defense to go through some growing pains. And so they may not be, you know, the 10-2 Sugar Bowl team. That being said, if Dave Aranda can repeat the 2021 performance this year, he's broken the game of football. He's absolutely changed it. And, 80 FBS program should stop what they were doing and start mimicking what he's doing, if he can replicate that success this year.
Well, and that's sort of a question I was going to ask, is how much is, especially the offensive side of the football, system versus, because he's only been there for what, 2-3 years now? I don't remember the exact time, but he hasn't been there long. And also, I mean, obviously the portal is sort of that, just 3D20s that give you a guy and, you know, you don't know what's coming out of it. But is it that good of a system? Or is it, I mean, is a system that is like 2009, 2010, 2011 Oklahoma State good kind of offensive system? Or are we just talking sort of a good to great system? What are we talking about here?
Okay, on defense with Dave Aranda, we're talking about a great system. Unequivocally. That he knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone, even the most like ardent of Baylor haters, can argue with that. That's absolutely true. On offense, I think that Jeff Grimes gets a lot of credit for what he's calling the reliably violent offense, the RVO. And that's defined by a bunch of football speak, you know, just says some things about getting out there and stretching the field and all that and making plays. And you love that. But their offense last season wasn't very good. They really, a lot of their benefits came from field position. So let me make sure I have this number exactly right before I read it incorrectly. They had 18, where did it go? Oh, in 2021, Baylor had 31 drives with starting field position better than their own 40-yard line. That's 21.3% of their drives. Damn. In 2020, they only had 18 such drives, which was 15, almost 16%. So, I mean, a huge increase in starting field position. You look at the Big 12 championship game where, one, they caught a break because Oklahoma State had some offensive down, had Jaylen Warren out. But you look at that, Baylor didn't score a point when they started in their own territory. Every single point came because Baylor was handed basically a field goal at worst in terms of field position there with the turnovers and with special teams. And so their offense was not very good last season. And you couple that with they're losing their biggest safety out, which was throw the ball to Tycon Thornton down the field because he's super freaking fast and anybody can get it in a window where he could run under and catch it. Without that, they're really asking a lot to replace on offense. So we're going to learn a lot about whether it's the scheme or whether it was the fact that the Big 12 was down last year, the fact that maybe Lincoln Riley wasn't as interested in game planning as he should have been, and then also that Oklahoma State was hurt at strategic times. So I think it's an open question. I'm certainly more convinced that the defense is a really, really good system. The offense, this is kind of the year we'll see, like, hey, Is it really that special? But they really weren't that great on offense last year, especially in the pass game.
Yeah, I mean, we can get into the Big 12 championship game if you want, but let's keep moving on. So one of the wild cards I'm looking at is West Virginia. They got JT Daniels in a quarterback. He was as high a recruit as he was for a very good reason. What do you think that does to the mix of the Big 12 having JT Daniels in?
Yeah, I think that JT Daniels definitely raises West Virginia's ceiling to intriguing. They really have a tough kind of break with their schedule and their non-conference stuff to do. I mean, last year, like, they probably should have lost the Virginia Tech game. They ended up 6-7. They probably were close to not being bowl eligible. I think if JT Daniels gets in there and Graham Harrell calling plays works as it should and Daniels is healthy, I mean, just the sheer increase in pass frequency that they're going to see from last season, they relied on Letty Brown a lot to bail them out against poor rushing defenses. If they can just pass more and pass efficiently, I really think that they will be a lot better. One of the big issues last year was that Daigie is not very mobile. And the offensive line was really struggling to protect him. When the offensive line protected Jarrett Daigie, he's a fine quarterback. I think that he'll do well at Western Kentucky because a lot of that is going to be get the ball out quick, not sit there, make multiple reads, not wait for your offensive line to give you, you know, three and a half seconds to make a pass. But I think JT Daniels' processing is really, really good. His knee is probably more healthy than people think. He probably could have beaten out Stetson Bennett. If you go to the message boards and you go down the conspiracy theories, his family doctor had a different plan of treatment than the Georgia doctors. And Kirby said, you know what? I'm not dealing with any of it. So I think that he's actually a really, really good quarterback and he's in a good opportunity to get a system hand tailored to him that could really just improve their efficiency just by them passing more, let alone having, you know, a lot of pretty decent weapons on offense.
Yeah. they're a sneaky good team. I think they return a lot of O-linemen. I'm really excited to see how JT Daniels does. Another wild card, I think is Kansas State. I know Adrian Martinez is, you know, he's had a career at Nebraska. I'm not going to say good or bad because he was neither. Where do you think Kansas State is at right now? And do you think they can contend for the Big 12 championship?
Yes, I would say that Kansas State's not even a dark horse or a wild card anymore. I think Kansas State heading into 2021, given what we know about their roster, is a front runner. They are a contender. And that's a couple of things. Before I even get to Adrian Martinez, I think they're going to have one of the better offensive lines in the nation. They have one of the best running back and pass catching running backs in Deuce Vaughn. If you want to impress somebody at a party, and you're watching a Kansas State game in whatever weird circumstance this is, just watch for Deuce Vaughn to motion in the slot and line up against the linebacker and then point at the TV and say, this is going to be a touchdown, because there is this chess match that goes on with, can we get Deuce Vaughn moving him around? Can we line him up against the linebacker? And if we do, we're going to score a touchdown on that dang little angle route every time. So, I think he's excellent. They've got a couple guys in Malik Knowles and Phillip Brooks that can create separation and can catch a downfield ball on offense. If you look at defense, I think they've got two of a really underrated set of corners. They
get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
You know, with EKB and with Julius Brents, they have a couple guys that are going to have no obvious asymmetry. A lot of Big 12 teams have a front runner corner and then kind of a second guy, and teams will pick on that second guy. Kansas State, you really can't pick on either of them, let alone the fact that they're going to have one of the best pass rushes in the conference with Felix and with Khalid Duke, who's back from injury. I really think that Kansas State has the whole picture. And then you throw in Adrian Martinez, a quarterback who's been volatile, but is experienced and has at least the physical tools. When he was in Nebraska, he was pressured like 40% of the time. We really don't know a lot about what Adrian Martinez can be in a functioning offense. So again, on paper, I can see a vision for Kansas State is experienced. They're disciplined. They're good at the key positions, cornerback, pass catching wide receivers, pass rush, and they're going to put a quarterback in a stable environment that gives them a little bit more positive volatility, a little bit more explosiveness as well. So I'm optimistic on Kansas State. I think we're getting close to the offseason chatter overrating Kansas State. But generally, I think that they are they should be a contender this season, especially even going in. I don't think they're a dark horse. I think they're a contender.
All right, so let's shift gears a little bit here. So give me your best reason why Oklahoma State will win the Big 12 and won't win the Big 12.
Okay, if Oklahoma State, so one, I'll plug my own podcast. We did the Oklahoma State preview a couple of weeks ago lingered and went deep. And so if listeners haven't heard that, for sure should listen to it. I think the knock on Oklahoma State is kind of threefold. One, I think Spencer Sanders has hit his ceiling. And so there's not much more that he can give you. You could argue if what he's giving you is enough. Last season, I think it was, although at times context dependent, it wasn't enough, but I don't know that there's a meaningful step forward for Spencer Sanders to take. I think we know who he is. So there is an inherent cap on the offense. You're losing your highest rushing running back in Jaylen Warren. You're also replacing him with, Dom Richardson, who's a little bit bigger. And, you know, some of the comments on him are he's got balance. He's got the high volume workload. But he doesn't get east to west. He's kind of a north south guy. So there might be not as much explosiveness from the running back position as we've seen from Oklahoma State the last couple of years. And, obviously at the wide receiver, you really lose Tay Martin, who is, just a guy who really, you created a lot of things through him. Now, those are my knocks on the offense. The third knock is you lose Jim Knowles, who was able to orchestrate this kind of chaotic mass of insane talent that Oklahoma State's defense had. He was able to say, here are seven guys who can get to the ball, I'm going to meaningfully put them in the right position to capitalize and thrive on preying on opposing defenses. That doesn't seem likely they're going to replicate that, even though I really like Derek Mason.
Right. So well, my issue there is more of, granted, I do think Knowles is a great DC, but a lot of those guys have been the defense for five, six, seven years because of the COVID year and everything else. So I wonder, was it Knowles or was it the guys who've just been playing for 6, 7 years? You know, that's kind of my idea, which is still an issue. Like it's going to be an issue replacing the, you know, especially the linebacker core. Right. You know, you can't knock on Rodriguez's don't grow on trees, you know?
Yeah, like that's not a knock to whoever is going to fill in behind him. That's exactly. The thing, like, Malcolm Rodriguez is not walking through that door, and you've got to do something about it. That being said, you have four edge rushers who could go start at any other Big 12 school and probably at 115 other FBS programs. And so there's a lot of opportunity. Derek Mason has played that 2-4-5. I think if you look and can read between the lines, one of those guys is going to move inside, and they're going to run the 2-4-5 and just absolutely be hell in passing situations. And so if I'm looking for optimism, I trust Derek Mason's track record. He didn't get fired at Auburn. He didn't leave in disgrace at Auburn. He said, nope, this is crazy. I'm going somewhere else. Yeah. And then on the offensive side of the ball, I think one of my knocks is also a positive. Spencer Sanders is who he is. You know what he is. And so you can design an offense around him. I think Casey Dunn is maturing. I don't know if he's the long-term solution, but I think he's learning. And you have Brennan Presley and Jaden Bray and Braden Johnson. I think three guys who will at least require some matchup thinking from opposing defenses. And Gundy has a really proven track record of, I can put the pieces together on offense. So if you say on defense, they have the guys, even though they've got some turnover, they have a pass rush that's going to take pressure off of that secondary really, really well. Then you say, I trust them on offense. I don't see any reason why they shouldn't be competing for at least that second spot in Arlington.
Right. So a question we've had, and me and Ian have yelled at each other about, is will Dunn make a leap essentially? Because I mean, we've been watching him for a long time now. You've been watching him as an opponent. He's been getting better, and we did, and granted, it's a bowl game, you have a month to prepare, whatever, but that Oklahoma State offense looked like it did 10 years, and I'm wondering if you think that's going to continue to where maybe Gundy's like, all right, take the reins off, you run, you do your thing, we're going to run up tempo, go fast.
I don't think that's going to happen. I think that bringing in Sean Gleason was Gundy's attempt to say, let me let someone come in and tinker with the offense and do things. And we saw how that ended. I think that Casey Dunn is a Gundy guy. And I think that I respect Gundy as one of the better offensive minds in football, especially given his longevity. And I think that he is kind of coaching Dunn. If you were trying to be positive about Oklahoma State, I would look at that Notre Dame bowl game and look at the play action stuff they're able to run. Look at how they got stalled out on the first couple of drives and made some adjustments. I think that Gundy working with Dunn is only going to improve Dunn. That being said, I don't think there's a switch. I don't think there's a next level where we say, oh, Casey Dunn is a wizard. I think we say Casey Dunn is a Gundy guy, and he can execute this vision really well and can improve at that. But I don't know that there's kind of like a higher gear for this offense, especially with Spencer Sanders at quarterback and with the limitations of you're losing your leading receiver, you're replacing your running back, and that's kind of an uncertain situation.
So just, and we've had this conversation on other podcasts, but just how just screwed is Oklahoma State if Spencer Sanders goes down? Like, if Spencer Sanders goes down, what are we talking, like 3 wins, 4 wins?
I mean, that's always an interesting question. And I honestly think, that Oklahoma State is less dude dependent than a lot of other systems. And so I'm not as worried about what happens if Spencer Sanders goes down as opposed to like if Dylan Gabriel goes down for Oklahoma, right? I think that's a really burning question, especially given his injury history. Sanders has struggled to stay on the field. That's like an objective reality. That's not anything about his characteristics, but like he hasn't played a full season, right? I think maybe exactly. One at the beginning. And so you've got to ask what happens. Obviously, you know, you really hope that doesn't happen. And if that does happen for any extended period of time, you're looking at probably we're fighting for the Cheez-It Bowl as opposed to, you know, the Alamo Bowl or one of the New Year's Six Bowls. That really does knock them down a level. But the explosive playmakers, I mean, if you know, Brennan Presley, you and I can throw the ball in space to Brennan Presley and he can go score a touchdown, right?
Yeah, he is fantastic.
As long as they can kind of manage that transition and find ways to get their playmakers the ball, if the defense is constant in that situation, it certainly brings him down a level. But I don't think Oklahoma State collapses without Spencer Sanders by any stretch of the imagination.
It's just weird having two like freshmen as the backups to especially like a fifth year guy that Spencer is. I mean, it's just a weird situation to find ourselves in.
You would like an intermediate option, but with the transfer portal, it's just hard to get a guy to stay there and say you don't have a path to the field. But I don't think that Oklahoma's like quarterback of the future is necessarily obvious. And so if one of those guys gets playing time, you get to figure out who they are. It's not the worst thing that will obviously. I mean, you don't want Spencer Sanders to get hurt. Don't hear me saying that. But
right.
There's some spillover benefits to one of those younger guys playing and to Gundy having a really clear identity on offense and saying, I know what I'm going to ask you to do.
Yeah, for sure. Ian, what do you got?
Well, I just want to thank Parker for backing me up on the Spencer Sanders, not hate train, but the he's got a ceiling train. I've been saying that. Dude, hop on the Alamo Bowl train real quick. We're going 9-3. That's what I've been saying. You know, that's probably my third year saying it, 9-3 Alamo Bowl. But I want to talk about Texas real quick. I love Quinn Ewers and just how Texas' offense is going to go with Bijan and Xavier Worthy. But I could also see them going 8-4. Like, where do you think Texas is? And I'm not going to say the are they back, but can they get back to the mountaintop is probably a better question.
Yeah, I am mostly worried about Texas's defense. I am mostly worried about Texas and their and their kind of youth and inexperience, and they did a lot of turnover, they did a lot of changeover, and that's not great on defense and kind of the system that they want to run and the system that they're trying to run and how they get guys in there. So I'm worried more about their defense. On offense, they didn't have great sequencing last season and really were limited by one card, maybe not being as ready as they thought. And Casey Thompson, I mean, you saw pictures of Casey Thompson's hand swollen up like a balloon. I think he's a fine quarterback. I think just bad situation on offensive line and was injured. That's just really hard, especially to carry a defense that you know is just going to give up points. So, if I'm looking at them this season, I'm not worried about their offense at all. I think you've got Bijan, you've got Roshan, really good backfield there. The offensive line, still a little bit of a question mark, but Sark can scheme around that. You've got Xavier Worthy, who is the most productive wide receiver in the nation, or in the Big 12 coming back, 30.3% of targets, I think. And you look at, they bring in Isaiah Nair from Wyoming, who had like 28% of his team's targets. So another really productive guy that gets in the mix. They've got some talent. Jaleel Billingsley from Texas comes in. And I really think they'll be fine in terms of weapons on offense. I love the hire of Brennan Marion as their inside receivers coach. I largely credit him for what Pitt was able to do last season. So I think that they will be, you know, Marion with 2 years of Worthy. Worthy's going to be around one guy. Absolutely. So the offense will be good. The big question is Quinn Ewers going to live up to the hype playing games? I think he went to school with Ryan Day for last year, and that was a really, really good thing for him to go get practice reps and kind of learn about offense and sit behind CJ Stroud. But he's going to be the guy, and we've seen, you know, that doesn't always translate directly to success. So that would be that, and the offensive line are my big questions on offense. On defense, I'm very worried. I think they'll be pretty unstable on defense, and I think they'll have to outscore opponents. We've seen that. Like the Oklahoma game, they got up and the defense couldn't hold on. I'm worried that that's going to be what will happen. Clearly, you can't put too much faith in their results last season. I hate to use the Q word, but they quit. They stopped and the coaches quit. The coaches said, this is not our roster. These are not our guys. We're getting rid of a bunch of them. And so there's obvious structural friction there. But I'm reluctant to call them back because there's so much uncertainty on the defensive side of the ball. But I certainly think they're headed in the right direction. I'm more confident about Texas this year than I ever was about any of Tom Herman's teams.
Can we classify what constitutes as back? Because I have I'm pretty sure we'll all have like different like reasonings for it.
Yeah, I think back in my mind is just entirely a meme. And so it's, are they the most important, like, are they can the media plausibly give them enough attention? Are they nationally competitive? Are they consistently more than 1 year in a row going to a New Year's Six Bowl?
Back for me for Texas would be like top 15.
But not one season, because they did fine with there was like the Herman year and the Ellinger year, and then he said we're back, and that was a bad idea. But like for Texas, it's sustained. Anyone can win 10 games, right? Winning 10 games in college football one time, you just got to strike gold with a quarterback, like, you know, just down year, injuries with your opponents. Like a lot of people can win 10 games at Texas, right? The issue is, can you do it multiple years in a row, which they have not been able to do any way, shape, or form. So we're not going to know if they're back this fall, right? We're going to know if they're on the right track, which I think they are. But back for Texas is next year. Are they going to be in the preseason rankings and in the postseason rankings 2 years in a row?
Yeah. I mean, when I think about it, whenever they won that Sugar Bowl against Georgia, like, okay, maybe they can run with that. If they had won like two or three more New Year's Six bowls within there, then that would probably be back. Right now they're not. And I agree with you completely. I'm going to talk about real quick. Can we talk about Iowa State? Can Matt Campbell succeed with his quarterback gone, his wide receiver, star running back Breece Hall gone? Where does Iowa State end up here in the shuffle? I'm sure they'll get lost in it, but can they make a bowl game despite everything they've lost?
I think they should definitely make a bowl game if Campbell's program is going in the right direction. I think last year was a little bit like in fifth grade basketball, I got fouled with no time left on the clock. And you guys can see me. I'm more of a wrestler, powerlifter type, not a basketball type, but I played as a kid. And I got fouled at the very end of the game, and they call a technical. And I had to shoot two free throws with no time on the clock and no one else on the court. And we were down 1 point. So I had two chances to tie it. I airballed both of them, right? Everyone was looking at me. It was terrible. I feel like in some ways that was kind of Iowa State's 2021. They had all this returning production. They were really high on 2020. They took advantage of the COVID year. And they kind of airballed both threes or both free throws. And so I'm not writing them off entirely, but I do say it's easier and easier to say that the 2020 COVID year was the exception, not the rule for Iowa State. And this year, they don't have any of the advantages from last year. So they really shot themselves in the foot with some special teams last season. My metrics had them graded out pretty well. Plus 9.1 points was actually just better than Baylor, but that doesn't account for special teams and how often they, again, shot themselves in the foot. One big thing to watch if you're looking at like football guy kind of things, they don't have Charlie Kolar anymore. And so they really don't have a bailout option on third down between Breece Hall and Charlie Kolar. Man, they could just convert automatically, right? They don't have both of those guys. I like Jarrell Brock at the running back a lot, but you're going to have to see how does Matt Campbell's system that is, again, a system for dudes doesn't require, or a system for guys doesn't require dudes. Like you can just, he can build around decent football players. How are they going to function when they don't kind of have that automatic bailout, when they stall pretty frequently? So something to watch. Their defense will be good again this year. I don't expect them to contend, but I really don't know how they'll have a much better year than last year, given all the turnover they have.
So we would be remiss, since we only got a few minutes left for your time here. How do you think this whole NIL stuff's going to like destroy college football? That is the question. If you listen to any college football, anything, it's all about how NIL is going to kill college football. So let's get your take on it. And he's gone. So yeah, NIL, man, going to be nuts. At least Oklahoma State's trying to get a part of it.
I would almost argue that the realignment would kill college football more so than NIL. Because NIL, you're still playing players, money's still coming in, right? With this new realignment, with USC and UCLA going to the Big Ten, bless you. Because they're going back to the Big Ten, they're kind of destroying some smaller brands there. And if you're not a national brand, I think your football team's in trouble. When you look at Cal and Stanford and Colorado, if USC and UCLA aren't there, where's their big check coming from? I think that Cal might end up shutting down their football program eventually. I don't know. But we're in a dangerous state. And I think if UCLA and USC get cold feet, I think that's actually better for college football.
Well, there's no way UCLA is doing it because they're like $50, $60 million in debt, something like that, for the athletics department. There's no way they're not cashing that check. So, Parker, you're back. So, like I said, we would be remiss to not get your opinion on like NIL realignment, all that good stuff.
Yeah, I think that the current NIL environment is a result of the NCAA being cowards for years and just not having a vision, not having a plan. And what happens is when you're behind, systems and institutions evolve without you, and they had no kind of say in the they refused to. It's not like it was out of their hands. They refused to have a say for fear of the liability in kind of how this institution of NIL formed and how these teams were able to compensate players. And they've gone and let Washington decide that for them. And it's the Wild West right now. But I will say that there's a couple mitigating factors that people aren't factoring in. One, I don't think that anyone's considering kind of the market value of players and how some of these players are still vastly underpaid relative to the demand out there. I also think that we haven't seen the first round of NIL busts. We haven't seen the first round of players who have gotten paid millions of dollars, signed contracts, and then been really, really bad and then get dumped. I think there'll be some market correction. There's obviously a lot of zeal. I think we'll see a lot more of these kind of, hey, we'll give you a stipend kind of a deal to attract the secondary and tertiary kind of level of players. But these number one players are still going to get millions of dollars. The deal is that just frees up other elite teams to compete for those guys. I think it actually kind of increases some parity because some teams aren't going to be able to just say, hey, you won't win a national championship somewhere else. Damn it.
At least I can still hear you, so that's good.
Could you hear?
I could hear that, but now you're gone. So you know what? We're having all sorts of audio visual issues, and I think it's been a good show as it is. So cowboys and cowgirls, we will see y'all next time.